It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And this is, of course, America the Beautiful. You already knew that, but what do you know about the life of the person who wrote the lyrics? Her name was Katharine Lee Bates. She was a poet, a professor, and a university administrator. She was an independent woman in an era when that was not common, but she was also, in her own way, more conservative than some of her liberated peers. All that and more is the subject of the new documentary, From Sea to Shining Sea, Katharine Lee Bates and the Story of America the Beautiful. The film is the work of a veteran public television producer named John DeGraff. I recently had a chance to speak with DeGraff before a live audience in the Collins studio at Illinois Public Media. They had just seen a screening of the film. You can see it for yourself on public television stations later this year. We'll have more information about that on our website. Because this conversation was pre-recorded, no calls, but let us know what you think about our program. The address is talk@21stshow.org. Again, talk@21stshow.org. John DeGraff, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here at University of Illinois.
So what drew you to the story of Katharine Lee Bates?
I've always made stories about people who inspired me. Over almost 50 years of filmmaking, probably 20 or more of those kind of stories of Americans who, and people from other countries who saw something wrong and didn't feel that their countries are living up to the ideals that they believed in, and worked to make that different in one way or another. Not always successful, but cared enough to be active citizens and make a difference. And so this story just seemed, over the years, is one that I should tell, but hadn't done it for quite some time. And then, of course, with the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution coming up, it just seemed that this was a natural time to tell this particular story.
There are a lot of resonances between what's happening in the film and some of the things that are happening today, right? Flirting with overseas conquest, America, you know, Greenland and Canada, how long ago those things seem with all the intervening events, but certainly rough treatment of immigrants is another one. What was your timeline? When did you start working on this project?
I started thinking about the project a couple of years ago. We did a little bit of shooting in the fall of 2023 and made a little sample video so that we could use that to raise some funds and support for the film. And then we did a lot of research and worked on all those aspects of it. What is the story? I selected a team of wonderful people to work with. Every television production takes a village, as I think, and radio too. And we started shooting in August of last year and completed the editing of the film in right before Christmas. So it was only about 4 months once we started shooting, but there was a lot of work leading up to that.
But crucially, before what's been happening in the last 9 months.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We could not have anticipated. We could not have anticipated how much life might mirror art, and not necessarily in a good way, but how we might be facing again some of the same issues that were prevalent at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th.
So talk about your research process. I know you've talked about a particular book that you read that you found very insightful in learning about Bates.
Sure. Well, the main biography of Bates is From Sea to Shining Sea, from which we adopted the title, of course, written by Melinda Ponder, who has spent over 20 years of her life researching the story as a historian living in Boston. And then I just went to the archives, the Wellesley Archives, which are full of a lot of the original materials. It's kind of neat to put your hands on the little 1866 diary that this young girl was writing in, to see the postcards home from Europe, to see the papers she graded and her, you know, high school diploma and all of those kind of things. In the archives and find a lot there. Then we went to Colorado and did photo research at Colorado College and at the Colorado Springs Historical Society. And interviewed different people and decided who we wanted in the film, and went primarily to Massachusetts to do the to shoot the interviews, but also to Colorado. And then we collected photographs, and then our big the big dilemma for me was always with a historical film where the subject has been dead for nearly 100 years, there aren't very many, there's no moving footage, and there are not very many photographs, and all the photographs of Catherine Lee Bates in existence are portraits. She's just staring at the camera. There's nothing of her doing really anything, not even teaching. And that was, how do I do that? I don't want to keep using shots where we zoom the camera meaningfully into Catherine Lee Bates' eyes.
The Ken Burns effect, as it's become known, yes.
I love Ken Burns, so I don't want to. But yes, sometimes when you have to do something so big, you just take. And I didn't want to do that. And I was like, how do we do this? And we thought of animation, but we thought that animation might make it feel a little too current. I mean, too much take you out of the historical context that we were trying to set for the film, having it in her voice, all of those kind of things. And that's when I had the idea to do illustrations. Got an artist who made first sketches, line drawings, and they were wonderful. She did overall 33 of these things based on little aspects of Bates's story, but we wanted them to come to life a little more. And so we talked about, she said, well, we can put watercolors in and things and brighten them up that way. And in that sense, have them both be similar to the photographs because they feel like that era, but also different in that they sort of brighten up the piece and give a contrast between the black and white and the color.
Yeah, you see it in color. It does add a different flair to it.
And the other thing was the song. So this the rights to the song are there. It's in the public domain. Anyone can use the song. The problem is with the performances. And so we had to figure out how can we use some of these performances, people like Elvis and Ray Charles and such, without paying a lot of money we didn't have.
Yeah.
And that's where it comes down to what's called fair use. And we were advised by a lawyer that the best way to do that would is you had to make a point in your fair use, which was this song is popular, to use a lot of very tiny bits. So you're not taking any large segment from anyone, and you're making a point. So the only song we really used any significant part of was Judy Collins' Bread and Roses. The others were all little five-second clips. And that worked for us. And then we got a country western singer from Nashville to actually perform the whole song so that we could use the segments from that, a young man named Blaine Howard, who was the Arkansas Singer of the Year for the past 3 years. But Blaine loved the subject. He loved all of this. And we felt that country music is also very much Americana.
Yeah.
And we wanted to show that this song could be popular in all genres.
Talk about one of the artistic decisions that struck me, and you see it right at the beginning of the movie, is that it's narrated in the first person. I'm sure you considered, should we have a sort of omniscient narrator? Should it be in a woman trying to embody this person? Talk about your thought process with that.
Well, most of my films have been quite traditional in kind of the Ken Burns style with a third-person narrator who tells the story. And frankly, I like that form. I'm not critical of that at all. And I was only planning to make a 3 to 5 minute sample video to raise money. And I thought, well, I don't want a narrator voice and then another voice. Let's just do this with her, you know, as if she's talking. And so we did that. And the historians all said, we like this. I thought they'd be critical of it. You know, how can you're right, putting words in this woman's mouth. You're an old guy writing for a woman. How can you do this kind of thing? But that wasn't the response.
Because to be clear, it is invented, right? It's not all from her diaries.
It's all based on her real information and all of that. And as much as I could be, after reading a lot of Bates, get a sense for her style and everything, but it's all created. And they all said, well, geez, it's more engaging that way, and especially because you want this for young people. I want this show to be particularly seen in the middle schools and the high schools and so forth. And she said, this will be much more engaging to them than the third-person narrator. So we decided to make the whole film that way.
All right, we need to take a break. We'll have more from my conversation with filmmaker John DeGraff. His documentary is From Sea to Shining Sea, Catherine Lee Bates and the Story of America the Beautiful.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of May, for purple mountains, majesty. Oh,
it's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with veteran public television documentary producer John DeGraff. I recently had a chance to speak with him before a live audience in the Collins Studio at Illinois Public Media about his new documentary, From Sea to Shining Sea, Catherine Lee Bates and the Story of America the Beautiful.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Bates, because she is in some ways, a thoroughly modern woman. One of the other things that I thought was interesting, and the film doesn't spend as much time on the relationship between Bates and Catherine Coman, but what do you understand about the nature of their relationship?
Well, we certainly understand that it was a very deep and loving relationship that lasted for 25 years, that they cared deeply about each other. The physical nature of that relationship, we don't really know. The historians disagree. I would say about half of the Bates experts say, yes, this was a lesbian relationship. Half say, well, no, they just were like wonderful friends for each other, and that it was not that uncommon at that time, because most Wellesley professors who could not marry, right, lived with other women. And they were in the closet in those days, you know, so whatever, we don't know. Bates wasn't advertising the nature of her relationship, and it was not a big issue for her because she was never criticized for it. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought it's wonderful, these two women together. So that's as much as we know. And as a journalist, I didn't feel like I wanted to surmise things that I didn't have clear evidence for.
Yeah, I was intrigued by this. I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole in my research. I found a National Park Service website that describes something called the Boston Marriage or Boston Marriages, which is an institution like this, right?
Yes.
Where two women live together, they can support each other, pursue career ambitions they wouldn't have been able to do in a traditional marriage at the time. But you really don't know if it was platonic or romantic.
And this was referred to as a Boston marriage. It was also referred to as a Wellesley marriage, with the same idea.
Interesting. Yeah, we had a debate on our program a few months ago, maybe even a year ago at this point, between a noted Lincoln scholar and some younger scholars who were questioning whether Lincoln himself was gay, right? This is something that intrigues historians. There are limits to what we can learn, though, really, especially applying modern thinking to the past.
I'm glad to be asked the question. I've actually been somewhat attacked in a couple of cases by people who were just completely convinced that I was whitewashing the lesbian nature of the relationship. And I had to say, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm trying to be as careful about the facts. I personally believe that probably was the case. But my views are different from some of the leading historians, and it was not. I mean, I could have gone into what so and so says this and so and so says that, but I didn't feel that there's nothing in Bates that makes this a big cause of her life, and I wanted to deal with the things that she cared about, that she was writing about in this song, and the things that led to the verses of this song.
Well, that's a great segue to talk about the song itself. So how does this go from a poem to a song?
People just started singing it. It's very simple rhyme pattern, and so it is simple to just start singing it. And there were some really horrendous versions out there.
I mean, I also read, though, that Auld Lang Syne
was one of the versions of the song.
America the Beautiful. You can hear it.
Yeah. Was sung to. But the version that stuck was a song called Materna, or a hymn written by a Newark, New Jersey church organist named Samuel Augustus Ward. And he had written this song a few years before America the Beautiful came out, and it was a song popular in the churches of the day, and people realized fairly quickly that it fit her words as well. And she personally liked it the best of the versions that were out there. So by 1910, that was pretty much the official melody.
The first and last verses have the lines, "America, America, God shed his grace on thee." It's true of the 1893 original and the 1911 version, but in between, 1904, I think, she changes the line to, "America, America, God mend thine every flaw, confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law." Why do you think she went back and forth on that? You say she softened.
Well, that verse is there in the 1911 version as well, absolutely. So she sticks with that. It doesn't show up until 1904, and it certainly, I mean, every indication then is that she was referring to what she saw as the U.S. expansionist policies of imperialism of the Spanish-American War in the Philippines. That's what confirm thy soul and self-control meant. But she had a secondary meaning for that, which was that she believed that in the Gilded Age and at the end of the 1800s, America was just becoming too materialistic, too focused on stuff, on things, on consumerism, which, of course, has become a big thing in our there as well. I made a film for PBS called Affluenza about consumerism in America. And Bates was very concerned with that as well. That was not the primary reason she put those lines in, but she does write about her concerns about our appetites for more and more stuff. She doesn't understand it in an environmental way that we're going to run out of resources and stuff. She just kind of thinks it's greedy.
And there's the line about spinning gold. I mean, I don't have it in front of me, but something about gold, making gold into...
Right.
Yes.
That line is, "America, America, may God thy gold refine." And that comes from her going to Cripple Creek, and that's in early on, although she expresses it slightly different at first, and then she revises it from "till selfish gain no longer stains the banner of the free" to "may God thy gold refine." But she goes the day after Pike's Peak, or 2 days after, she goes to this mining camp nearby, and she's just appalled by the greed that she sees there and the destruction of the landscape and all of those things. And she just thinks, we have to have a different idea of wealth. We have to understand wealth as community, as friendship, as nature, as beauty, as expression, and not simply material gain. And so she was very clear about that. So it's metaphor. Bates did not want to hit you over the head. The first time she felt that "till selfish gain" was hitting you over the head. It was just out there. And she wanted the song to be more metaphorical, give you a chance to do a little more work yourself to understand the meaning.
I was also struck at the end of the song, or at least at the end of the first verse. The verse everybody knows, right? I think you'd acknowledge most people don't know much beyond the first verse. It ends with, "America, America, God shed his grace on thee," right? And I've always heard that as a boast or a sort of assertion of American greatness. And you even, like, it's not just me. Ray Charles says, "God done shed his grace on thee."
And as much as Catherine Lee Bates would have loved Ray Charles's rendition, she would have not been happy with the way Ray Charles changed the words, because she did not mean at all that God had crowned thy good with brotherhood. It was what she wanted to see happen.
It was an aspiration, a plea.
You know, let's make this better, and let's make it better for the whole world. She was very clear in her final speech. She said, you know, "When I'm talking about sea to shining sea, I don't just mean the Atlantic to the Pacific. I mean all the seas of the world, because we are all brothers and sisters." And she, I don't know if she used the word sisters at that time, but obviously she would today. She's very much a feminist, and she does use gender language of the time, "God shed his grace on thee," but that's what people were saying then. I think it's not because Bates wasn't a strong feminist. She certainly was.
Why do you think we've lost some of these meanings that she intended over time?
Well, we only sing the first verse, usually, for the most part. And that is an affirming verse about the beauty of America. And Bates wrote letters to friends of hers saying, for instance, that I've written this song, I disbelieve. When I went out west, I saw what a beautiful country this is. I mean, this is just, we live in this glorious place. But until our institutions and the way we treat each other match the beauty of the country, we're not all we can be. And in fact, I'm afraid that we'll follow the British Empire and the other empires because we have the wrong values. She was very explicit about that. So I think, though, it became just a popular song. It's nice to sing, good words. And it was taken. And this wasn't red or blue. I would say what I found is that whether people are red or blue in the United States, they all tend to see the song as this America First, rah, rah, you know, kind of song, which is anything but what Bates's intent was. And so part of this is to ask us to think about these kind of things. Let me give you one more example of that. The Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag was written in 1892. In Boston, at the same time, by someone who Bates knew, a minister, a Baptist minister named Francis Bellamy. Now, Francis Bellamy wrote the pledge because he was upset by what he saw as the treatment of immigrant children by Native American-born children in the Boston schools. They were bullied, they were treated badly, they were called names, and he felt that this was not how they should be treated. They should be welcomed. And his belief was that if the kids in the schools both said the same thing together, morning after morning, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, they would come to believe that as, in fact. They would see it that way, and they would see these immigrant kids as their brothers and sisters. Bellamy wrote explicitly that he did not believe that religion should be part of the pledge. Even though he was a Baptist minister, a very religious man, he said, you know, we have separation of church and state. We want all these people to be included in this. And so I think many of you know that the words under God were not added to the Pledge of Allegiance until 1954. They were not a part of the original pledge.
Eisenhower era.
Yeah, McCarthy era.
Fair. countering the godless communists, basically.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, yeah. That's exactly why that was brought in.
Should America the Beautiful be our national anthem?
What does the audience think? I don't know.
Show of
I
hands?
Mean, I think.
I don't know. Let's, okay. If you think Star Spangled Banner should stay, applause. Scattered okay. Applause. America the Beautiful is an alternative. Scattered, maybe. No
kind
opinion.
Kind of 50-50 here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe there I personally think it should. You know, in 1930, a national poll was taken of Americans about those two songs and about which of those two songs should be the national anthem. And America the Beautiful won that poll 2-1. But Congress decided, no, you know, it's not the right thing. We need an anthem that's more patriotic, because they understood that
warlike, frankly.
They understood that there were criticisms in it and so forth. And so they voted in 1931 to make the Star Spangled Banner the official national anthem.
To the bane of many pre-football game singers who have struggled to hit the notes.
Yeah, yes. This is great. I'm really enjoying your questions.
Well, there was an effort in was the Kennedy administration to make it the national anthem. I mean, Ray Charles was a proponent of that.
Ray Charles lobbied Congress for 6 years to try to make it the national anthem, even though he sang it slightly different than Bates intended. But overall, he certainly got her meaning, and that's what he wanted too.
I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
John DeGraff is a veteran television producer. His latest documentary is called From Sea to Shining Sea, Catherine Lee Bates and the Story of America the Beautiful. It's going to be on public television stations next month. Check your local listings. That's it for us today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. America! Yes.